It's still a port area. Maybe pirates put up here from time to time, or people that Lindstrom has problems with.
He stepped through the gate, watching the terrain ahead for any signs of movement. Bridget looked around as they continued into the ancient vill's interior.
Is this what you saw in your dream, Kane?
Yeah.
Kane stared up at the massive white stone building perched at the cliff's edge. He couldn't see the Caribbean Sea on the other side of the cliff because of the angle, but he had no doubt that it was there. The sky continued to lighten, going from steel gray with hints of color from chem clouds in the distance to robin's egg blue.
Tulum wasn't the original name of this place. Scholars think it was first called Zama, which was a bastardization of the word Zamal, which meant morning in the Mayan tongue.
Kane nodded at the rising morning sun.
The name would have fit.
Tulum means fence or wall. Tulum was also used as a base of operations during the Mayan War for the Castes, which lasted from 1847 to 1901.
That bullet was more recent than that.
Less than 10% of the people lived within the walls. The houses outside the walls were huts, not made of stones. That's why they're not here now.
This place was 10 times bigger than what it looks like now?
Yes. Only the wealthy, the religious, and the important people lived within the walls. Tulum was the only Mayan city on a coastline in the empire.
Do trading here?
That's the general consensus. Cozumel is an island farther east. They believed other trading took place there as well. But the tall building there, called the Castillo, or castle, might have been used as a lighthouse to light the way for ships.
Anybody live here now?
Kane shook his head.
I don't think so.
He glanced down at the wag tracks marring the soft, rocky ground.
But there have been people through here lately.
They passed the rectangular building with the pinkish stones and the faces at the corners.
Did you see the faces on the building, Kane?
Yeah, Baptiste. They were in the dream, too.
They look like representations of Chak, the Mayan god of rain, or Itzamna, the creator and life-giver.
They kind of look like a lizard, too. Reminds me of our old friend Enlil.
Kane continued leading them through the dense growth that had invaded the courtyard. They passed a rectangular hole in the ground, overgrown with weeds that Bridget said had been a gravesite. Only a little farther on, he saw the ragged hole in the north wall where the earthquake had torn through the karst. Less than 30 yards from the broken section of the north wall, Kane heard the unmistakable sound of running water. Cautiously, Kane crept forward, keeping his rifle tucked in close to his body. He halted at the edge of the hole opening to the cavern system below and peered down. Careful to keep his head in line with overhanging brush so he wouldn't be limbed against the dawn sky. A surprising amount of light filled the cavern below, rendering the huge chamber a little lighter than twilight. Kane guessed that the white limestone reflected most of the light that entered the caverns, trapping the majority of the light and making the most of it. The German submarine lay in the deepest part of the water that partially filled the cavern system. It heeled over on its starboard side against a shelf of rock that rose out of the underground water. 7 armed men sat on the rock shelf around the campfire. The smoke chimneyed up and flowed along the cavern roof, heading away from the opening where Kane was and going farther down the tunnel. Kane assumed the smoke was following the wind passing through the tunnel, evidently coming out somewhere on the other end. The water below was crystal and placid. Even from 30 feet up, Kane saw multicolored fish swimming lazily through the water. Open wooden crates, warped wood showing obvious signs that they'd been underwater for some time, sat in piles around the men on the rock shelf. Not much had apparently been worth salvaging. But somewhere down there was the chalice. Kane drew back, keeping the sun from casting his shadow down across the crystal clear water below. He waved to Grant, drawing him close.
I count 7 men.
Kane slid the rope coil from his shoulder.
But I don't figure they'll give up whatever they've found easily.
We can chill them.
Kane shook his head. The men were like any of the others in Campecheville, just trying to stay alive.
They haven't done anything to us.
That all changes after the first shot, unless you just want to walk away from this.
No, I can't.
If we announce ourselves, we give away the advantage of surprise.
I know. But I can't do it any other way. Not and keep it clean.
We'll do it your way. Whichever way it goes, we'll handle it.
Kane crawled back to the hole in the ground. Then he raised his voice.
You men down there!
Instantly, the 7 men took cover behind the stalagmites thrust up from the rocky shelf, as well as the water-warped crates.
Who the hell are you?
It's not important.
What do you want?
The submarine. You people get clear and we'll let you go.
Fuck you! We already declared salvage rights to this son of a bitch!
Grant glanced at Kane.
Ain't nothing left to do but take this one the hard way, unless you want to walk away.
Kane considered that option only briefly. The dreams and Balaam's information had left him little choice in the matter. Before he could say anything, a humming drone echoed through the air above. He glanced up. A crimson lacquered airwag shot by overhead, the wings tilting slowly as the pilot scouted the ground.
Wei Kiang's people, they're taking a hand in this.
Why?
They spy on everybody. Maybe they already knew about Lindstrom's hunt for the chalice.
But why come here now?
Maybe they found out about us leaving.
Kane turned that over in his mind for a moment, then shook his head.
They followed Lindstrom. He must be somewhere behind us.
He turned and gazed back to the west, the way the road lay that led up to Tulum.
That means we got two groups bearing down on us, getting on toward a one percenter here.
Kane watched the plane circle around and head back to the west. Abruptly, machine gun fire sounded in the distance, echoing over the hills. The little crimson airwag turned away, skirting a section of jungle.
We could go back. There's a good chance we can get around Lindstrom's people in that jungle, or just hide out until they're gone.
Not without the chalice.
Kane grabbed the coil of rope and started tying it around his feet.
If Balaam is right about that being part of the mana machine, I can't allow it to stay here.
But there was more, he knew, although he didn't tell Grant. There was also the promise he'd made to the dying king and to the lady. Maybe he would tell Grant at a later time, but he wasn't going to say it now.
Secure the line to the tree.
You going to rappel down into that cave?
You saw the ropes alongside the cave opening. It's a steep grade. If we try to go down that way, they're going to pick us off.
He finished tying a quick-release knot that held his booted feet together.
Drop me halfway to the water.
And how far is that?
Kane pulled himself to the edge of the opening.
25 feet should do it. I'll need to use your copperhead.
Grant tossed over the weapon. Kane sat up, peering briefly down into the cavern below and hoping that the sides were as straight as he thought they were. Otherwise, the cavern walls were going to beat the hell out of him. He held the copperhead in one arm, checked the magazine, and accepted the bandolier of spares that Grant handed across. He snapped the security strap on the .45 at his hip. Grant finished hauling the other end of the rope around a nearby tree, making certain he could control the rope easily.
I've got you secured.
Kane glanced west again and spotted dust plumes rising from the trail above the jungle canopy.
We're not going to have much time to pull this off.
Less if you keep talking.
If it comes to it, leave me below and get clear.
If I have to.
Without another word, Kane placed his back to the opening to the cavern and toppled inward, falling like a rock.
Wei Kiang is trying to fuck us over.
Harry Lindstrom stood in the wag's rear deck and swung the .50-caliber machine gun around to track the crimson air wag cleaving through the air to the south. The rounds thundered through the machine gun, sending spent cartridges into the brass catcher. None of the rounds appeared to touch the airwag, and it continued on its way serenely through the blue, cloudless sky.
Son of a bitch!
Lindstrom released the machine gun trigger and slapped the weapon angrily. Narita Vasquez and Tillman regarded him from the rear seat.
Maybe they're only watching.
Lindstrom remained standing, watching as the airwag disappeared in the distance.
This might not be the first pass-through for those airwags. They could have already spotted Tulum. Wei Kiang's people, Ren, or one of the other Tong commanders could already be en route.
Then we'll deal with them. If they think they can take us here, they've made a fatal mistake.
Lindstrom didn't say anything. He shifted his weight unconsciously as the wag rumbled over the uneven road.
The gates are too narrow to get a wag through. Not for long.
They hadn't seen the wag that Kain had taken, and he couldn't help hoping that the man had gone another way and encountered more trouble than they'd had while trying to make up lost time. The driver halted 100 yards from the entrance to the ruins.
Johnson, make me a door.
He swiveled the machine gun around to cover the entrance. Other men and the rest of the wags did the same. One of the men from another wag ran forward and pushed a Plasex satchel charge on either side of the entrance. He trotted back to the wag.
Ready!
Lindstrom gazed back to the west, the way the airwag had disappeared, and saw it appearing again on the horizon. There was also a smudge of dust clouds hanging over the jungle canopy. He had no doubt that the Tong had managed to put together a ground assault team as well.
Bastards!
This far from the bay, there was no way to set off the radio signal that would destroy the floating oil rigs. But the last laugh would be on them if they didn't make it back. If he wasn't back in 24 hours, the timer was set to automatically send the signal. Baron!
Do it!
Cain fell, keeping his legs loose as the bullets from his opponents chopped the air around him. His eyes raked the upside-down view of the cavern to orient himself. He kept his body loose, hoping not to get hurt in any way when he reached the end of the rope around his ankles. He glimpsed the dizzying array of stalactites and stalagmites swirling around him, the crystal-clear water below him, which looked like up in his present frame of reference. The men on the rocky shelf scrambled to new positions. If Grant hadn't been busy manning the rope, Cain knew he would have picked off two or three of the men guarding the submarine while they were in motion. Then the rope grew tight around Cain's ankles. Grant handled the rope expertly, working it so the drag didn't stop suddenly and take a chance on yanking Cain's legs out of the sockets or whipping his back. As he slowed to a halt, hanging at least 40 feet down from the cavern roof and now another 30 feet from the underground lake, Cain let the copperhead fall into position at the end of one arm, then secured it with the other. He fired controlled three-round bursts, catching two men in the center of the bodies with not even a heartbeat between the two actions. Their bodies spun to a halt on the rocky shelf. Bats suddenly fluttered from among the stalactites, their dawn slumber disturbed by the riot of noise. Cain drew a bead on a man behind one of the warped wooden crates. His line of fire ripped splinters from the fragile wood, then he adjusted and targeted the Sec man's head, which erupted in a rush of ruby blood and gray-pink brain matter. Three, Cain told himself, keeping track. His thoughts swung constantly to the location of the final piece of the mana machine. This was the chalice, the part the king had promised the lady in exchange for the luck and aid she'd given him during the years. Cain scattered more shots among the surviving Sec men, driving them to cover and keeping them stirred up as he swung at the end of the rope. His motion through the air made it more difficult for him to acquire targets, but the surprise maneuver had netted him three confirmed kills. He roared through the rest of the clip, blazing rounds across the rocky shelf and aiming at the cavern wall just behind one of the men taking cover behind a crate. The bullets ricocheted from the limestone wall. Not all of them struck their target, but enough of them hit the man that they slapped him to the ground. He lay twitching, dark red blood suddenly staining the limestone. Then the copperhead blew empty, and the sudden silence of the roaring automatic weapon was at once noticeable. The three survivors took heart in Cain's apparent helplessness while dangling at the end of the rope. They stood and took more deliberate aim at him. Cain transferred the assault rifle to his left hand. He bent at the waist with effort, having to overcome the weight of his upper body as well as gravity, and grabbed the loose rope he'd left in the knot.
Clear!
Grant responded immediately.
Clear!
Cain yanked the rope, loosing the knot. He plummeted toward the crystal-clear water below, angling his body so he'd go deep. If he remained near the top, the three survivors would shoot him easily. Then he hit the water, finding it only slightly chilly. It closed over him, drowning out the sharp staccato reports of his opponent's weapons as they searched for him. Bullets zipped through the water, leaving visible contrails thanks to the light coming from the hole in the earth above. Cain swam, knowing the gunners could easily see him. The explosion that broke through the western wall of Tulum caught Bridget Baptiste off guard. She'd been intently watching the sky, spotting the crimson airwag in the distance as it came back around. As the blast filled the air with broken rock and flying debris, Bridget dived to the ground behind a line of boulders. Rocks shattered against the boulder with sharp cracks, and smaller rocks rained down around her like grape shot from a cannon. Domi cursed, her words unrecognizable, the tone unmistakable. Lifting her head from the ground, covered with dirt and fine debris, Bridget looked back at the western wall. A huge hole had been blown through the stone bulwark. Dust swirled in the opening, obscuring it for a moment, but there was no mistaking the wag that suddenly roared through the gap in the wall. The vehicle jumped and jerked as it rolled over huge chunks of stone and mortar. Domi reacted instantly, lifting her .357 Magnum blaster in a two-handed grip. She fired as quickly as she could, aiming at the driver's side of the wag. The windshield glass chipped, showing holes as the bullets punched through. One of the trees in front of Domi took two direct hits, leaving white pulpy scars in their wake. The wag rolled to one side and slammed into a tree, coming to a reluctant stop. Bridget recognized Harry Lindstrom, pushing himself up on the rear deck of the wag. The man fit himself behind a .50-caliber machine gun and started raking the jungle with heavy fire. Other wags roared through the opening in the wall and spread out. Bridget's immediate guess was that at least 40 men were aboard the wags. The rising dust cloud skimming along in the valley that held the road leading to Tulum told her that even more were on the way. She turned to Grant and yelled at him.
I see them. Well, it's a damn fact that we're not going back the way we got here.
Brigid glanced at the yawning mouth of the cavern near Grant's position.
From what Kane said that Balaam told him, there's another opening in that cavern system.
That's a hot zone down there right now.
Brigid looked back at the advancing line of men.
Might be safer there than here.
Without warning, the first crimson-lacquered Tong airwag was joined by a second. Both of them streaked toward the inner courtyard of the ruins, locking into an attack path. Kane swam underwater as long as he could. By the time he surfaced, his lungs begging for air, bright pinwheels spun in his vision. He came up behind the bulk of the listing submarine, using it as cover from the hostile guns on the rocky shelf.
Fuckers behind the boat!
Running footsteps spanged off the limestone, echoing within the cavern. But that sound was partially masked by the roar of the explosion from above. Kane kept himself focused with difficulty. Evidently, Lindstrom and his squads had been closer than any of them thought. He crowded up against the submarine, working hard to tread water in his boots and clothing. He slipped a magazine from the bandolier Grant had given him and rammed it home into the copperhead. Three men, at least, he reminded himself, because that had been how many he'd been able to visually confirm, still remained in the cavern with him. His bruised chest hurt as he breathed, and the air inside the cavern seemed thick, hard to get into his lungs. Bats fluttered against the cavern roof, darting in between the stalactites and shadows where the natural light didn't touch even after being reflected from the limestone surfaces. Kane knew none of his opponents could hide up in the stalactites, but the movement kept pinging his point man's radar.
Did we get him?
They fucking filled the air with rounds. If we didn't get him, the fuckers got all the luck a man would ever need.
The statement wasn't true, Kane knew. None of the shooters had tried to lead his plummet into the water. They'd all shot where he'd been, and even at the distance and factoring in the speed of the rounds, he hadn't been there when the bullets had arrived. He'd counted on that for survival. A scared man always tries to catch up, never taking a split second and working ahead of a situation.
Cover the ends of the boat! Bannister will probably try to come around if he's still alive.
Kane felt something bump into his left leg at mid-calf and jerked in the water, thudding up against the submarine. He glanced down, his hand already streaking for the combat knife in his boot. A fish as long as his arm looked up at him briefly, then turned and darted away, disappearing in the crystal-clear water. Kane forced himself to breathe out. Machine gun fire echoed into the cavern from the battlefield above. Brigid, Domi, and Grant were seriously overmatched.
He's still over there. I heard him.
Gonzo, climb on top of that fucking boat and see if you can get a bead on the bastard.
Fuck you, I ain't climbing up there.
It's a high ground, you fuck. You get him for sure.
You get him then.
Kane spotted movement at the forward end of the submarine. He lifted the copperhead, letting the water drain from the muzzle so he could fire without worrying that it would jam. A small outboard drifted into view. A rope tied it to the prow of the submarine. The gentle current that swept through the water, trapped in the cavern system, had pulled the outboard around the front of the sub. No one was aboard it.
Stoop bastard probably drowned. That's why we ain't seen him no more. Must have hit his head on a rock when he went into the water. That water's over 100 feet deep. Fuck it. Maybe he was so weighed down he just didn't come up again.
Kane tried to figure out where the three men were from the sound of their voices, but it was almost impossible in the rolling echoes of the cavern. He took a few deep breaths to charge his lungs, then took a final breath and submerged. The water was so clear that even in the half-light he had no problem seeing the bottom below. White, powdery sand caught the light there as well, illuminating the lower reaches of the water. He didn't know if it was really 100 feet deep. The refraction of the water made it impossible to guess, but he supposed it was possible. The size of the caverns was impressive as hell. The water didn't carry the salt of the ocean either. It was pure and clean, but it smelled strongly of minerals when Kane had been on the surface. He kept his eyes open in it easily. He swam to the bottom of the submarine, feeling the pressure tighten in his ears and bruised chest, knowing he was going deeper than he realized to get around the German vessel. He trailed his free hand above him, following the curvature of the submarine's outer hull. He didn't see any real signs of damage aboard the boat and guessed that whatever damage had been inflicted had popped open seams that had let the sea in and dragged it to the bottom 250 years ago. The vessel was surprisingly intact for having shifted around in the sea for all that time. His lungs near bursting again, not able to get fully acclimated to the humid air trapped in the cavern, Kane felt relieved when he finally reached the apex of the hull and started up again. The submarine lay next to the outcrop the men had camped on. Less than 6 feet separated it from the outcrop's edge. Kane swam up, already tracking the movement of two men in front of him. While swimming, he pulled the copperhead over his shoulder, leaving the muzzle pointed down. With the angle involved in shooting up, he knew he might not be able to get the barrel clear of the water in time to use it. He fisted the .45 at his hip. He came up out of the water quietly, hardly making any noise that could be heard over the crash of gunfire and explosions coming from overhead. The first of the men was only 10 feet away, standing behind a cover of a stack of crates that contained machinery parts. The preternatural senses of a predator had to have warned the sect man, because his head swiveled around toward Kane.
He's over here! The fucker's over here!
He tried to bring his assault rifle around, tightening his finger on the trigger. A line of jacketed rounds struck sparks from the submarine, closing in on Kane's position. Kane raised the .45 clear of the water, tilting it quickly to drain the water from the barrel, then hoped all of it had spilled free as he dropped the sights over the center of the sect man's chest. Kane squeezed the trigger 3 times in quick succession, riding out the recoil each time and keeping on target. The heavy .45 caliber round smashed into the man's chest and drove him backward from cover. Blood suddenly masked his lower face, coming from his ruined lungs as his heart pushed the crimson fluid through his system. He stumbled backward and tripped over the ring of rocks that had been set up around the campfire. A silver bowl containing some kind of fish stew shot out of the fire and overturned nearby. Stew mixed with spattered bat guano, creating a mosaic across the rocky limestone ledge. Kane heaved himself from the water, staying in a low crouch that nearly blinded him with pain from his bruised chest. He kept the .45 loose and ready before him, following his line of sight with the weapon just like he'd been taught back in the Cobaltville Magistrate Division. Another man at the other end of the ledge peered over the barrel of his weapon at Kane. Without hesitation, Kane snapped off 2 rounds, knowing there was no way to avoid the sect man's aim. It boiled down to who killed whom first. One of the .45 rounds missed the man, but the second crashed through his skull and knocked him down. A line of bullets smashed into the cavern roof as the dead man fell backward. A half dozen chunks of bat splatted onto the rocky ledge and the submarine. The man lying in the fire continued to struggle weakly for a moment. He lacked the strength to raise his weapon. The stink of his burning hair and flesh filled the cavern. Kane put a mercy round between the man's pain-filled eyes. The corpse dropped back into the fire and continued to cook. The third man stepped out from behind a jagged section of the cavern wall at the back of the rocky ledge that had provided an inspired hiding place. He brought up the shotgun he carried and locked it into his shoulder. Kane took 1 step to the right, toward the back of the ledge, and threw himself into the air, knowing he'd never avoid the shotgun's discharge by trying to run. The sect man wasn't practiced at his killing craft. He kept the shotgun blast low, toward the center of where Kane's body had been. Most men would have been caught flat-footed by the deadly swath that ripped through the air, only Kane wasn't there when the double-aught discharge arrived, and it ripped through the side of a waterlogged crate. Still in the air, arcing his body, hoping to land somewhere near his feet instead of on his head as he flipped, Kane pointed the .45 at the sect man and squeezed off the last 2 rounds in the pistol. He tried to keep both shots onto the center of the man's chest, trusting the knockdown power of the .45 round to at least keep him in the game and provide him a chance to recover after hitting the ground. Neither round hit the sect man's chest. One struck the man in the left shoulder, spinning him and knocking him a foot to the right. It was a combination of skill and luck that put the second round through his throat, ripping it out in a crimson spray that painted the cavern wall beside him. Kane slammed against the ground, landing on his back, and not even coming close to landing on his feet. The impact drove the wind from his lungs and almost sucked away his conscious mind. His bruised chest felt as if he were covered in red-hot brands. It took 2 attempts to get to his feet. He shucked the empty magazine from the .45, pushed a fresh one into place, then holstered it and took up the copperhead. A brief recon of the rocky ledge assured him that no one remained in the cavern. Kane turned his attention toward the gaping hole in the cavern roof.
Rand!
But his voice was lost in the sudden hammering of explosives. Rock broke free of the cavern roof on the other side of the hole.
Rand!
Lindstrom took cover as the Tong air wags continued their bombing run across the ruins. The two pilots had obviously worked together before because their movements were fluid and certain. They fired the twin machine guns mounted on the front of the small air wags and strafed the ground while the passengers dropped impact-triggered bombs over the side.
Ren and the others must have seen us leaving Campeche View. They decided it would be better to take you out here, away from the ville, than try to deal with you there. Probably have the ville under a full-scale invasion right now.
Lindstrom knew her assessment was likely correct. Even if the Tong couldn't take the ville by force, it wouldn't take long for them to starve everyone out. Dark rage filled him, and he desperately hoped that the sect teams he had in place in Campecheville could hold out long enough for the preset timers to run their course and explode the bombs aboard the oil rigs. He ducked his head as one of the impact bombs landed less than 30 feet away. The ground vomited up, sailing high into the air and crashing back down a few heartbeats later. He was pelted with dirt and rock, some of the chunks large enough to leave fist-sized bruises. Blood streaked his face from a cut on his scalp. Lindstrom's thoughts raged around Kayin. Every time in the past, he had failed at getting the mana machine because of something Kayin had done. Sometimes they'd worked together to free the chalice from enemy hands, as they had when they'd acted as agents for the Celtic king on behalf of the Tuatha De Danann. They'd recovered the chalice then and returned it to the king. Lindstrom had returned the device under protest because he didn't want to confront Kayin, but he'd set up their betrayal to the Romans. He just hadn't counted on getting killed as part of the bargain. Machine gun fire from one of the wags pursued the airwags. The gunner was even getting closer, starting to lead his target when the airwags returned. The 7.62mm machine guns chewed through the jungle and across the ground, leaving small craters in their wake, and clouds of dust and debris rose from the earth. The gunner in the wag stayed with his target, scoring on the lead airwag. Smoke belched from the front of the airwag, then flames flickered to life. The airwag's twin machine guns chopped into the wag and the gunner, jerking him like a puppet at the end of its strings. Then the airwag passenger tossed an impact bomb over the side that scored a direct hit. The wag erupted in a whoosh of flames. The airwag, streaming smoke and fire, tried to recover, but was visibly slowed by the damage it had taken. Before it could gain altitude, the landing gear snagged in a cluster of treetops. The airwag stopped suddenly and flipped, pancaking into the trees and breaking into pieces like a child's toy. The other airwag lifted, having no choice but to leave his wingman. But Lindstrom knew the pilot hadn't abandoned the battlefield when it started climbing again and coming back around in a looping circle. In almost the same instant, wags poured through the yawning gap that had been created by Lindstrom's munitions man. All of them carried Tong hatchet men. Two of the wags were fast attack vehicles similar to sandcats that Lindstrom hadn't seen before. Besides having 50 caliber machine guns, the wags also sported 75mm cannons as part of the armament. As Lindstrom watched, the lead wag turned its long gun on a pair of wags parked under nearby trees. The wag crews scattered immediately while the drivers tried desperately to clear the area.
Bastards had the war wags already put ashore somewhere outside Campecheville. We missed that.
Lindstrom cursed. He'd guessed about the extra ships, since Wren's vessel hadn't had any severe problems with pirates. The only reason pirates wouldn't have attacked would have been if the force was too large or too well protected with onboard artillery. Evidently, the ships from the Western Isles had possessed both.
Didn't expect those fuckers to be so bold.
They want the oil fields, and they don't want to have to deal with anyone else.
Lindstrom looked back at the opening in the cavern, then glanced at her desperately.
The U-166 is down there, Narita. We can still make this work. Those three people up there must be part of Kayin's group. He hasn't left yet.
The warwag's main gun belched flame, and the scream of the shell filled the air for one instant before the resulting explosion deafened everyone. Shattered trees toppled, bringing down still other trees and brush, as well as men who hadn't cleared the area quickly enough. The sound of the main battle gun echoed over the bowl-shaped depression that Tulum occupied on the karst above the Caribbean Sea. Lindstrom turned to Tillman, who was hiding behind a boulder a few feet away.
Tillman! You said the caverns had another opening.
Yeah, about 30 miles away. There's at least one boat down there, tied off at the submarine. At least it was there when I left.
Another salvo of cannon rounds spewed from the long guns aboard the war wags. Thunder rolled over the immediate area, then dirt and debris filled the air as more trees shivered and fell. Flames raced across the canopy of the trees from the air wag that had been shot down, leading black smoke up into the blue sky. Lindstrom turned to Vasquez.
The caverns are our only way out. Order your men to charge that area.
She hesitated only a moment, staring at the area near the opening in the earth. Then she raised her voice and yelled orders. Lindstrom led the charge, pushing himself up from the ground and racing forward. Some of Vasquez's sect men passed him, spraying the area around the cavern mouth with auto-fire. A black man leaned around a tree with an M14 in his hands. Coolly, he shot into the approaching sect men, picking off targets as if he had all day to do it. An albino rose from hiding, grins in both hands, and flung them at the advancing sect men. But there was no time. The albino girl had obviously pulled the pins and counted down part of the time. The grins exploded while they were still in the air. It was a dicey move, because she could have been caught up in the twin blasts as well. Instead, she vanished from sight just as Lindstrom threw himself down. The grins exploded, one only a short time after the other. One of them was an anti-personnel munition that threw out shot in all directions and ripped men unlucky enough to get caught up in the blast of bloody caricatures of anything human. The other grin was a smoker that unleashed white tear gas that filled the area and stayed put because the breeze was non-existent. The three people near the cavern's mouth got to their feet again. The white-haired albino threw herself into the cavern opening as if she were diving from a cliff. The black man offered a covering fire as the woman with red-gold hair started for the opening.
No!
Lindstrom ran toward her, certain that Cayenne was again about to put the mana machine out of his reach. Vasquez broke cover and brought up her CAR-15.
Hurry! Damn it, that was stupid!
The black man didn't hesitate as Lindstrom charged across the distance. The M14 rose swiftly and surely to his shoulder, and Lindstrom could almost feel the crosshairs on him. Lindstrom fired his hand blaster instinctively, but knew none of the rounds even came close to their target. He ached, waiting for the bullet that would surely kill him, even as he drove his feet hard across the uneven rocky ground. He held his breath, but the tear gas was already burning his eyes and nose. Vasquez's CAR-15 blasted behind Lindstrom, and the black man spun away. The woman with red-gold hair tried to bring up her weapon. Not daring to slow down, Lindstrom threw himself at the woman, watching as the assault rifle in her hands came up. He caught her quickly enough, though, and the rifle was trapped between their bodies when he slammed into her. Lindstrom's forward momentum carried them both over the edge of the yawning cavern mouth. He spotted the albino hitting the crystal-clear water below them as they dropped. Kane watched as Domi hit the lake cleanly, then plunged beneath the surface. Then he watched anxiously as Bridget came spilling over the side of the cavern mouth with a man wrapped around her. They fell to the underground lake, and there wasn't a damn thing Kane could do except watch helplessly. Then some kind of explosive round landed near the open mouth of the cavern. The edge around the opening crumbled, spilling huge rocks from the cavern roof. If Bridget survived the plummet to the hard, unforgiving surface of the lake, Kane knew there was a good chance some of the falling debris might kill her. Domi's head popped up above the surface, nearly to the submarine's side by the time Bridget and the man hit the water. Kane ran across the rocky ledge and leaped onto the listing submarine. It was the highest vantage point possible. He trotted to the stern of the submarine and peered down into the water. More debris rained down from above, creating dozens of ripples and impact areas. Bridget and the man who'd been holding her had disappeared. Grant leaped through the yawning opening above and dropped in a clean dive, but Kane could tell by the way the other man had hit that he was hurting. Domi reached the rocky ledge and pulled herself up, filling her hands with her blaster as other Sekmen threw themselves into the cavern.
Tongs! They attack Lindstrom!
Kane nodded. Attacking Lindstrom while he was away from Campecheville and couldn't trigger the self-destruction among the oil rigs was only good strategy, something he would have done himself. He peered into the lake, looking for some sign of Bridget. An instant later, her red-gold hair caught his eye as she surfaced 50 yards out. She brushed water from her face and started to swim, but before she could move, an arm snaked around her neck from behind. Lindstrom surfaced behind Bridget, holding her hostage with a knife at her throat. His wet hair matted to his head, and he grinned malevolently at Kane. His eyes held mad cunning. The knife glinted at Bridget's throat, fisted tightly in his hand.
I'll chill her, Kane! You know I will!
Grant came up only a few yards away, then glanced around and spotted Lindstrom holding Bridget. Other heads popped up quickly after that, all of them belonging to Lindstrom's Sekmen.
I know you will.
Half-buried dreams and memories of other atrocities Lindstrom had engineered over a score of lifetimes pushed at Kane's mind. Maybe in this life he'd professed good intentions about Campecheville, but Kane couldn't forget the things the man had done in the past. Lindstrom, under another name, had been responsible for the death of the king who had served the lady.
Where's the final piece, Kane?
Water lapped up to his nose, causing him to splutter. Treading water while holding onto Bridget for cover was demanding. Bridget kept sinking into the lake and having to fight her way clear as well.
I don't know. I haven't had time to look.
Find it! Maybe I'll let her live!
If you don't let her live, you'll die next.
He swept the lake with his gaze, discovering that 11 Sekmen had survived the plunge from the cavern opening. And there was the woman that had been with Lindstrom back in Campecheville, Narita the Bleeder.
Get the chalice, Kane!
Kane turned, knowing the Sekmen were going to head for the outcrop and clambered ashore. Searching quickly, Kane looked through all the crates that had been opened on the rocky ledge. Most of what had been taken had been ruined by the centuries of lying at the bottom of the ocean. There were also spare assault rifles and a couple of RPG-7 rocket launchers. Nothing looked like the bowl he remembered from his dreams. Then Kane remembered the fish stew the men had been cooking over the campfire when he'd arrived. In disbelief, he walked over to the dead man still being burned in the campfire. Flames clung to the man, burning his clothes off and sizzling the fat from his flesh. The stench of burning hair filled Kane's nose. He walked past the dead man and knelt to pick up the bowl that had held the fish stew. He turned just as the first two of the Sekmen reached the rocky ledge and pulled themselves up. They stayed back from Kane. Holding the copperhead in one hand and the chalice in the other, Kane turned toward Lindstrom, who remained floating behind Bridget. Kane noted in grim satisfaction that Domi had hauled herself up onto the submarine and had taken a position behind the conning tower. The albino thumbed fresh cartridges into her blaster and kept a wary eye on the Sekhmen occupying the other end of the rocky ledge from Kane. So far, none of them seemed really intent on encroaching on Kane's space. Grant crawled up onto the submarine as well and took up a position beside Domi. Blood streamed from a wound in his upper left arm.
You okay?
Been better.
Grant added another stripper clip to the M14.
The tong?
Grant shook his head.
No going back that way.
Kane nodded toward the front of the sub, knowing Grant would spot the motorboat tethered there. Grant nodded, indicating that he'd already noticed it.
Kane!
Kane lifted the silvery bowl into view. When he'd looked at it earlier, he hadn't noticed the fine webwork of circuitry printed into it. Perhaps other cultures, thousands of years in the past, had believed the circuits were only a design affected by the Maker.
That's the chalice!
Yeah, you killed the king for it.
A small smile played on Lindstrom's lips.
You remember that from all those years ago?
He was a good man. He deserved a lot more than the betrayal you showed him.
He was a fool! He was going to give that back to the lady!
What lady?
Narita Vasquez stood at the forefront of the men, both hands extended with pistols filling them. Kane ignored her.
That chalice is pure power, Kane.
If you can feed them, you can lead them.
You remember.
Can't forget. A lot of people have died while you've tried to put your hands on the chalice and its other component parts.
They had to die. You know that I was linked to that device, don't you?
Kane said nothing.
I finally saw that in my dream. Enlil was afraid the mana machine would fall into the wrong hands. He marked me through genetics, as well as pre-programmed memories. The mana machine is mine by rights.
Lindstrom treaded the water with greater vigor, coming out slightly from behind Bridget. Vasquez pointed a hand blaster at Kane. She brimmed over with hostility.
Give him the chalice, and throw down your weapons.
Kane looked at her.
No. I'm not giving up my weapons. They're the only things keeping us even.
Narita Vasquez stood silently for only a moment, then she smiled slightly.
You're going to get somebody chilled.
Once we start, there's going to be a long line.
Vasquez pointed her pistol at Kane's head.
Do you think you can get that assault rifle up before I blow your brains out?
Maybe. But if I don't take you out, they will.
He nodded at Domi and Grant, who held their weapons trained on her.
Ha ha! You're going to get everybody chilled.
If it comes to it, I'll settle for that. How do you want to play this out?
Leave him alone. All we want is the chalice, Narita. We can walk out of here. If that's what Kain really chooses to do.
And if he doesn't?
Chill him, and I'll chill this woman.
Okay.
Did you hear what I said, Kain?
I heard.
Kain was aware of a lull in the action above ground. Saw shadows shifting around the yawning mouth of the cavern. Tong hatchet men lined up around the opening, evidently triumphant over the forces Lindstrom had brought.
Give me that damn chalice!
Lindstrom yanked Bridget's hair and pulled her head back, exposing her throat to his keen blade. Without a word, knowing the scenario was playing out to a deadly close, Kane flung his arm out, throwing the chalice in Lindstrom's direction. The silvery metal bowl spun through the air, catching glints of light. Using the motion of the chalice flying through the air, Kane brought the copperhead to his shoulder and sighted deliberately. The chalice was still in the air when he took up the trigger slack and squeezed on through. Lindstrom's eyes were locked on the silver chalice as it flashed through the air. Kane felt the copperhead buck against his shoulder and saw flesh fly in a bloody eruption from the side of Lindstrom's head. He'd missed hitting the man flush. Still, the impact of the bullet drove Lindstrom backward and broke his hold on Bridget. Bridget wasted no time in swimming toward the submarine. Kane swung back to his left, keeping the copperhead up and at the ready. Before he could fire again, two bullets smashed into his side with stunning force. Knocked off balance and the wind driven out of him, Kane fell back heavily to the ground. For a brief moment, he wondered if one of the bullets had found his heart. Then he rolled over and opened fire, joining the firepower Grant and Domi were unleashing. The ranks of the Sekhmen dwindled quickly. Most of them were unwilling to fight standing toe-to-toe. They broke and ran, and Kane swept the copperhead's deadly swath over them. The bullets chewed into the Sekhmen, sending them tumbling, knocking down men who'd suddenly decided to stand and fight. Either Grant or Domi put a round into Vasquez's face, exploding it into bloody ruin. She sat down heavily on the floor, a look of surprise on her features until it was covered by blood. In the next instant, the cavern filled with a bull roar of a 50-caliber machine gun. Glancing up, gathering his feet under him, Kane saw that the Tong hatchet men had maneuvered one of the wags around to take advantage of a full-size 50-caliber machine gun. The tracer rounds sizzled when they hit the water and threw up 2-foot-high geysers. Brigid came up next to the submarine, gasping for breath.
Baptiste!
What?
Get the outboard!
Kane tossed the copperhead toward Grant, then ran for the water's edge. The wounds in his side burned like hell, but they weren't terribly debilitating. He dived into the water, ignoring the floating dead men who had fallen from above and hadn't remained in one piece. The water burned Kane's gunshot wounds when he went under, and his bruised chest screamed as he swam as hard as he could. He threw his arms forward, cleaving into the water and pulling himself forward. He glanced up, seeing the silvery chalice floating on the water right side up, riding out the ripples that crossed the surface of the underground lake.
Kane, what the hell are you doing?
Kane kept swimming, knowing he couldn't have explained the need that pushed him toward the device Enlil had given the Pharaohs thousands of years ago. The mana machine was directly linked to the Gaia Force that filled the world, and the king Kane had fought with had given his promise to the lady. But Grant wouldn't have understood any of that. Bullets from the Tong machine guns slapped the water around Kane as he swam. He glanced back as he stroked again, spotting Brigid aboard the outboard boat, pulling at the engine. He barely heard the blat of the engine starting. Then he reached out and seized the chalice as it floated on the water. The metal felt cold and hard in his grip. He treaded water for a moment, taking a deep breath, then turned to swim toward the outboard. Domi had already climbed aboard the small boat with Brigid, but Grant stood on the submarine with a rocket launcher tube over his shoulder. The Tong machine gun fire reached fever pitch, burning down into the lake.
Fire in the hole!
Kane swam for the outboard, sucking in air now, his lungs burning from exertion and his chest throbbing. Swimming with the chalice was difficult because it slapped and pushed against the water with every other stroke. He was grimly aware of the rocket leaving the tube over Grant's shoulder. Mesmerized, Kane stopped in the water to turn and watch the rocket streak across the distance toward the opening in the cavern roof. The warhead missed the Tong hatchet men standing around the opening and slammed into the cavern roof itself. The resulting explosion was almost deafening in the enclosed space of the cavern. Kane watched incredulously as the cavern roof went to pieces under the weight of the Tong warwags. Almost in slow motion, the cavern roof collapsed, sinking down and sucking men and machines after it. The roar of breaking earth filled the cavern, and the impact of the rock tonnage, as well as the warwags, created huge swells on the lake. Kane was slung forward like a rag doll in the grip of a giant. The water rolled over his head for a moment, submerging him. He held his breath and peered up at the cavern roof to keep his bearings. Without warning, Lindstrom suddenly shot by overhead. The man caught Kane's shirt with his free hand and brought his other hand, with the knife still held tightly in it, streaking toward Kane's throat. The whirling water lifted Kane and Lindstrom clear for an instant. Kane reluctantly released the chalice and grabbed his opponent's knife arm.
Time to die, Kane!
Kane held the knife hand back, the blade only inches from his face.
No!
Kane remembered how Lindstrom had betrayed the king and the other warriors who had stood so valiantly with him. A hesitant look filled Lindstrom's face. Kane drew the .45 from his hip. He stayed locked together with the man as the swells rippling through the underground lake pushed them up. He thrust the .45 into Lindstrom's face. Insanity gleamed in Lindstrom's eyes.
Go ahead, Kane. Chill me again. But I'm linked to that chalice by Enlil. I'll just get it next time.
Kane looked at the man.
No, there won't be a next time.
Then he thrust the pistol into Lindstrom's mouth, breaking teeth. Before Lindstrom had time to struggle or gag, Kane pulled the trigger, blowing out the back of the man's skull. Lindstrom's head sagged like a sack emptying its contents. Kane pushed the corpse from him and swam after the chalice again, catching it easily.
Kane!
He glanced up as Brigid Baptiste brought the outboard around through the choppy water. Grant shoved out a hand, caught his, then drew him aboard. Overhead, the cavern roof continued to crumble, and the tear in the earth above the underground lake continued, pulling down some of Tulum's ruins as well. Brigid turned the outboard in the other direction, following the path of the huge cavern system as the water level rapidly started to rise. Kane gazed at all the destruction, dimly aware that Brigid had turned control of the outboard over to Grant as she started dealing with the wounds in his side.
It's okay, Baptiste. They're through and through. Didn't deflect off a rib and bounce inside.
But she cut his shirt off anyway and started working to staunch the bleeding. Kane watched the destruction raining down from the cavern roof. There was no sign of pursuit from the Tong. Thankfully, the outboard also carried a large mountable light on the bow. Domi switched it on, and the bright light chased away the dark, allowing Grant to safely steer their craft through the caverns. Relaxing a little, Kane leaned back as Brigid continued examining his wounds. His mind drifted, recalling the images and events he'd seen in the dreams Balaam had sent him. Some of them seemed so far away now, like memories of things other people had told him. But he remembered the lady and the king's promise to her. He gazed at the chalice in the bottom of the boat and knew what he had to do. Kane gazed up at the opening they'd reached at the other end of the cavern systems. The trip had covered every bit of the 30-plus miles Brigid had mentioned, and the sights throughout the underground world had been awe-inspiring. Brigid had bandaged Kane's and Grant's wounds as well as she'd been able to. None of them were life-threatening, and Dufour could clear up any complications once they got back to Cerberus. Grant steered the outboard toward a rocky shelf with steps carved into the side of the stone wall. Iron rings set into the stone offered mute testimony that the shelf had been used as a dock in the past. Domi leaped from the outboard and tied off the line to one of the mooring rings. The hole in the cavern roof showed a deepening, twilight-blue slate sky shot full of diamond-bright stars. The shadows inside the cavern system had lengthened, and during the past 20 minutes the battery-powered light on the outboard struggled against the darkness that filled the caverns. Kane clambered aboard the rocky spit of land stiffly. His chest felt as if iron bands had wrapped it, and he knew from experience it was going to take a few days before he got back to 100%. He carried the chalice in one hand.
Ladder here!
Domi pointed a small flash she had found in their confiscated boat at an iron ladder punched into the wall. She took the lead, moving easily into the 60-foot climb. A chill wind blew against the back of Kane's neck. He thought for a moment that he heard his name. He stopped and turned back toward the deep lake. The water was as smooth as glass, picking up pink and light purple coloring from cavern walls. Nothing moved out in the water. There'd been no sign of pursuit, or that anyone that had fallen through the cavern roof had survived. It had been hours since a corpse had been within sight of the outboard. Brigid stopped beside Kane.
What's wrong?
Nothing, Baptiste.
Kane surveyed the still water, feeling more certain of his decision.
Did you hear something?
No.
Kane took the chalice in one hand, torqued his body, then threw it out into the lake. The silvery bowl flew out over the water, then started down toward the surface of the lake. For a moment, Kane had thought he was wrong, and thought he was going to have to get wet again just after having gotten dry at last. Then, amazingly, a column of water splashed up from the lake and caught the chalice. Instantly, the chalice was dragged below the lake's surface and disappeared.
Was that an arm?
Kane studied the lake, but no trace remained of the water column or the chalice.
Did it look like an arm, Baptiste?
For a moment, that water column looked exactly like a woman's arm.
Maybe it was a trick of the light.
Not trick of light. That was a woman's arm. Saw it myself. No mistake. What's a lady doing in the lake?
Making sure a promise was kept.
Kane felt suddenly lighter and more energized. He saw the king's face in his head. Then he turned and headed for the ladder on the wall.
Let's go.
Kane sat on his haunches in the hills ringing Campecheville 38 hours later, his gaze raking the ville through binoculars. They'd taken their time during the trip back from Tulum, traveling at night to avoid the heat of the day and to give their wounds time to heal over a little. They'd also been on the lookout for the survivors of the Tong group, as well as anyone who might have come back looking for Lindstrom and Narita Vasquez. They'd passed no one. Dawn rose in the sky behind Kane, spilling down into the sloped bowl that held Campecheville. Out in the bay, only crumpled wrecks remained of the floating oil rigs. Many of them were still burning, and huge spills that flickered with low-level fires continued burning as well. Grant, seated beside Kane, grunted.
Automatic timers. Only thing it could have been.
Kane nodded and put his binoculars away.
It's going to be a long time before anyone rebuilds this area into what Lindstrom had it operating at.
Yeah, but for oil, somebody will try.
The red-lacquered Tong warships sat at anchor out in the distant western horizon. Evidently, they hadn't been able to negotiate with the people still surviving at Campecheville. A skirmish line of crates and wags formed along the docks, and small boats patrolled the harbor.
That's an armed camp down there, Kane.
Kane nodded and rubbed at the whisker stubbles covering his chin.
I know. Maybe they'll be able to make a go of it. Even against Wei Qiang's ships. We'll rest up here, then go down after dark. With all the confusion going on down there, we should be in good shape.
Because we're obviously not Tong men.
Right.
The fact provided a flimsy cover at best, but Kane felt certain it would prove enough.
We'll locate the Mattrans gateway and use it to get back to Cerberus. And if that doesn't happen, we can take a ship out of here.
Sounds like a plan. What do we do until then?
We rest. We might not be the only ones who decide tonight would be a night for skulking through Campecheville. I'll take first watch.
Grant didn't argue. Despite the leisurely trip back from Tulum, all of them were still worn from the past few days of hard traveling. Grant crawled back up into the tree line where they'd left the wag they'd recovered from the Tulum site and went to sleep under the vehicle. Domi joined him. Kane remained where he was, looking out over Campecheville and the burning oil wells.
What Lindstrom was doing wasn't all bad.
No.
If it had worked, it would have been a good thing he was doing.
It wouldn't have worked. There's an old saying they teach mags. Kill a man's enemy, he's free for the day. Teach a man to kill, he's free forever.
There's one about fishing, too. Give a man a fish, he eats for a day. Teach a man to fish, and he eats every day.
Till somebody comes along and takes his fish away. Makes you wonder which saying came about first, doesn't it?
Why did you throw the chalice away?
I didn't throw it away, Baptiste.
Kane started to tell her what had happened, but he didn't. Somehow putting it into words took something away from it. What had happened had just happened.
It was a promise that was made a long time ago.
If the machine would have worked, those people down there could have used it. They're going to starve.
Or they'll leave. Or maybe they'll broker a deal with Wei Qiang's people or some of the local pirates or traders.
Having the machine would have made it easier.
The machine would have made it too easy, Baptiste. That's what Balam was telling me. Enlil was able to lead the pharaohs and everyone else he needed to control later through the mana machine. If you can feed them, you can lead them. That's a basic law in any beginning society. People who rise to power do so because they're smarter than the rest of the population and can provide knowledge they need. Or maybe they're stronger or kill easier. That way, they're more able to protect the group they're leading. But those people don't make the other people dependent. They teach them things. Either knowledge or the conviction to stand up for themselves.
The machine makes them dependent.
Yeah. If Lindstrom chose to freeze out certain segments of his society, the others would have no choice but to go along.
It gave him absolute control over them.
It would have.
Kane was silent for a moment, watching the streaming black smoke dissipate out toward the horizon, lingering over the Tong warships waiting in the distance.
What I did was right, Baptiste. There are some people who are going to be hurt by my decision, but I believe that they'll be better off in the long run. I have to believe that.
Bridget was silent for a moment.
A magistrate wouldn't have to believe that.
Yeah, but I haven't been a magistrate for a long time, Baptiste.
He pushed out a breath from his sore chest as he gazed down on the ville where factions were already squaring off against each other in the streets.
Things were easier when I was a magistrate. Simpler.
Simpler isn't always better, Kane.
Bridget slid her hand into his. Kane held on to her, felt her warmth, and drew it into the cold places of his heart. His world had changed as surely as those people in Campecheville, and none of them could go back to the way things were. Bridget leaned her head on his shoulder, and he let himself go distant from the violence breaking out in the streets of the ville below. But he couldn't help thinking about the way the chalice had disappeared. Part of him didn't want to believe an arm had reached up and taken it below, but another part of him knew that was exactly what had happened. The Lady of the Lake, maybe a manifestation of the Gaia force of the planet itself, had taken the chalice back where it had come from. Enlil had used the Earth's own electromagnetic fields to create the device, and the Lady had reclaimed what had been taken from her. The king had told Cain that, and Cain believed it. But thinking about the Gaia Force able to interact on a personal level left him feeling very confused, especially when he had to wonder about his own ties to it. After a while, Cain let it all go and simply drew comfort from Brigid's presence. For now, that was enough. Outlander's Prodigal Chalice is a Graphic Audio production. Outlanders and all characters are trademarks owned by Harlequin Enterprises Limited, used by others under license. Copyright 2002, Worldwide Library. All rights reserved. Production copyright 2005, The Cutting Corporation. All rights reserved. Performed by Terrence Aselford, Nanette Savard, Thomas Penny, Richard Rowan, and Colleen Delaney. Additional red shirts by The Dead Giveaways. Directed by Terrence Aselford. Produced by Rick Rowan and Dwayne Beeman. Executive producers James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornett. Dialogue editing by Brian Rogers. Graphic audio sound design by Chris Rowan and Terrence Aselford. The Outlander's theme was composed by Norman Vanderslice. If you enjoyed Outlanders, be sure to look for James Axler's Deathlands, available at Road Stops Everywhere at 1-800-670-5220 or at www.graphicaudio.net, where you'll find samples of all our Action Pump titles, as well as free downloadable extras, forums, and podcasts. Keep listening for a preview of another Graphic Audio title.
The following preview is of a Graphic Audio production rated for mature audiences due to scenes of intense violence and sexual situations.
Available now from Graphic Audio.
From Deathlands 56, Sunchild.
Fireblast! Where are they coming from?
They heard us first, lover, so we've got the lion's share.
Christy could see the other party collecting the dead children and holding their ground. And as suddenly as it had started, they were through to the center themselves, with Harvey and Downey close behind. Ryan turned to the sec chief.
Where's Dean?
Harvey shrugged. Rankine was pinned down by three muties, his Lee Enfield 303 having been knocked from his grasp by a thrown rock. While Jake and Bodie were in front of him and plowed on regardless, Dean was close enough to spot the three muties descend. They were too close to Rankine for the youngster to risk a shot, so he holstered his Browning high power and flew at them. A high kick caught one at the point of his jawbone, just beneath the ear, shattering the bone and driving shards of it into his brain. The second mutie was grabbed by the hair, his head pulled back, and a straight-handed chop to the throat taking him out. Rankine was able to deal with the third mutie himself, grasping fingers reaching the barrel of the Lee Enfield. Pulling it into his grip and grasping tighter, he swung it so that the stock crashed across the mutie's nose, bloodying his face and throwing him backward.
Thanks, kid.
Thank me if we get out of here.
Dean turned his eyes toward the surrounding crowd of muties. Some of them had started to fight one another, confusion and bloodlust clouding any reason they possessed. Rankine and Dean joined the others in the center. Dean joined Mildred in positioning two children over their shoulders. Rankine and Jake took another two, while Ant and Dee took the final pair.
Form a circle. Fire out when need be, and we head for the main road. I know these fuckers. Once we get out of the light, they'll be too scared to follow.
Hope so.
The odds still bothered Ryan, though, as did the fact that Doc seemed to be choosing the wrong time to get distracted, staring at the painted totem. Doc turned to the one-eyed man.
When we get out, then I fear I shall have something of import to discuss.
Worry me later. This is gonna be a bitch.
The sound of a blaster discharging cut through the yells of the muties.
I thought you said they didn't have blasters, Harvey!
It was Sunchild himself who had the blaster. Where he had found it was something none of them could ever know. The fact that he had no idea how to use it was undeniable. The mutie leader appeared in the middle of the crowd, the scarlet of his blood blending with the colors on his robes, running together in a mess of red as it flowed from the wound in his shoulder. Whatever else, the Mutie leader had immense reserves of strength and stamina. He waved the blaster in the air, yelling in a fury even more incoherent than the chanting he had previously led. It was hard to see in the glare of the firelight, but it looked like a long-barreled blaster, possibly a .44 Colt Peacemaker. The armorer strained his eyes to tell, wanting to know how many shots the Mutie would have left, especially as he had just discharged the second round. None of the party had seen where the first shot was directed, but it was an even bet that it was as random as the second, which fired off at an oblique angle, stopped by the soft flesh of a Mutie with only one arm, the other showing just a few fingers flapping at the shoulder. Now the Mutie had no arms, its only true limb blown off at the elbow by the heavy lead slug, ripping sinew, flesh, and bone at such short range. The companions and Sekhmen encircled the poles, facing out. What had been difficult before was now shaping up to be a deadly proposition.
You said they didn't have blasters. Our entire attack was based on that, but they do.
Harvey shook his head, momentarily thrown.
Never seen the bastards use them before. Didn't even know that they had them.
Seems certain they don't know how to use them, so maybe we'd better get going before they do.
Harvey nodded.
We keep tight, lay down a covering fire, staggering shots to preserve ammo. But first, I think we need to carve ourselves a little path.
The uncertainty that had plagued his voice a few moments before was now gone, as the Sekhman's tactical mind clicked into gear, going through the permutations of what was possible in this situation. From the leather bag at his belt, he produced an old grin. He pulled the pin and lobbed the bomb overarm toward the road out of the ville. Ryan noticed that a few of the Muties automatically followed the path of the grin as its dark shape arced in the light, their inbred idiocy responding to stimulus even in the middle of a battle. The Sekhmen laid down a volley of fire, driving the Muties back, while Harvey counted carefully, hissing the numbers between his teeth.
Now!
He hit the ground hard. The Sekhmen around him did likewise. The companions took only a split second to realize what Harvey had been counting and followed. The grin exploded, either on impact with the ground or else in the air directly above. It was hard to tell as it landed somewhere to the rear of the pressing crowd of Mutie Sun Children. Shrapnel from the grin spread out in all directions, and the air was suddenly filled with shrill screams as those at the rear of the crowd were either hit by the white-hot metal or thrown forward by the concussion of the blast.
If you can't find that hot graphic audio title you're looking for, just head to www.graphicaudio.net, where you can order it in CD or MP3 disc format. Or, the fastest and cheapest way, download that puppy and play it on any of the many devices that'll play Windows Media. And if you're on the road or just a total computer feeb, snatch up the phone and call 1-800-670-5220. That's 1-800-670-5220 or www.graphicaudio.net.